Pacifica. This is Democracy Now! Virginia teachers have ended one of the longest strikes in state history, winning a 5% raise for all state workers. Will West Virginia inspire teachers in Oklahoma and other states to go on strike as well? We'll get the latest. Then, as President Trump's top economic advisor, Gary Cohen, resigns, we'll look at how Democratic senators are working with Republicans to roll back key financial regulations passed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis.
This bill is a punch in the gut to American consumers. Only a bunch of bank lobbyists and their friends in Washington would call this a consumer protection bill.
Plus, we go to Texas, where the country's first primaries just took place. A record 50 women were on the ballot in what many are calling the year of the woman. We'll go to Austin to get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In West Virginia, teachers have ended their historic strike after state officials agreed to raise the pay of all state workers by 5%. The strike began on February 22nd and shut down every public school in the state. It was the longest teacher strike in West Virginia history. Meanwhile, teachers in Oklahoma are gearing up for a potential statewide strike. We'll have more on West Virginia and Oklahoma after headlines. The Justice Department is suing California over the state's so-called sanctuary laws, which limit local law enforcement from cooperating with federal immigration agents. The Justice Department is arguing California's laws are unconstitutional and, quote, reflect a deliberate effort by California to obstruct the United States' enforcement of federal immigration law, unquote. In response to the lawsuit, Governor Jerry Brown said, quote, at a time of unprecedented political turmoil, Jeff Sessions has come to California to further divide and polarize America. Jeff, these political stunts may be the norm in Washington, but they don't work here. Sad, the governor said. The lawsuit marks the first time under the Trump administration has sued a local or state government over its immigration laws. President Trump's top economic advisor, Gary Cohen, has announced he'll resign amidst a dispute about Trump's plan to impose tariffs on steel and aluminum. Cohen's the director of the National Economic Council. Before taking the position, he was president of Goldman Sachs. He's now part of an unprecedented number of people to quit Trump's White House. But during a news conference with the Swedish prime minister on Tuesday, President Trump denied there's chaos in the White House.
Many people want every single job. You know, I read where, oh, gee, maybe people don't want to work for Trump. And believe me, everybody wants to work in the White House. They all want a piece of that Oval Office. They want a piece of the West Wing.
The Project for Government Oversight is calling for the Security and Exchange Commission to launch an insider trading investigation into why billionaire Trump associate Carl Icahn sold $31 million in steel-related stocks in the days before Trump publicly announced the new tariffs. Icahn sold off more than a million shares of the crane manufacturer Manitowoc Company, which is heavily dependent on steel imports. The company's stock price went on to fall after Trump's public announcement of the 25% tariff on steel. Carl Icahn served as special economic advisor to President Trump before he resigned in August after the New Yorker magazine raised concerns about conflicts of interest, including Icahn's heavy lobbying for a rule change that affected the profits of his Texas-based petroleum refining company. Meanwhile, the Office of Special Counsel says White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway twice violated the Hatch Act by endorsing Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore while speaking in her official capacity for the White House. The Hatch Act restricts employees from using their official government positions for partisan political purposes. Adult film star Stormy Daniels is suing President Trump after his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, tried to pressure Daniels not to talk publicly about an alleged affair she had with Trump in 2006 and 7. Stormy Daniels' lawsuit says Trump never signed the 2016 nondisclosure agreement, making it null and void. Michael Cohen has said he paid $130,000 of his own personal money to Daniels to keep her quiet. The Wall Street Journal reports this money transfer was received on October 27th, only 12 days before the presidential election. The Journal also reports First Republic Bank flagged the transfer as suspicious and reported it to the Treasury Department. This could amount to a violation of federal election law. As California Congressman Ted Lieu tweeted, hush agreement and side letter attached to Stormy Daniels' filing essentially shows coordination between real Donald Trump, Cohen, and Daniels. That means the $130,000 payment from Cohen to Daniels to silence her during the campaign violated federal election law. Penalty is 5-year felony, he wrote. In news from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, United Arab Emirates advisor George Nader is cooperating with the investigation and reportedly gave testimony to a grand jury last week. Nader has ties to both current and former Trump aides. Mueller appears to be investigating whether money flowing from the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, to Washington influenced U.S. foreign policy, particularly regarding Qatar and the Saudi and Emirati-imposed blockade against the Gulf neighbor. The New York Times reports Nader attended a January 2017 meeting in the Seychelles, along with a Russian investor close to Putin and Blackwater founder Eric Prince, who served as an informal advisor to Trump during the transition, was with him during election night, and is also the brother of Betsy DeVos, Trump's billionaire education secretary. The Seychelles meeting was brokered by the Crown Prince of the UAE. A year later, in January, Nader was on his way to Trump's private Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida to celebrate Trump's first year in office when he was detained by the FBI at Washington's Dulles International Airport and questioned for more than 2 hours. All this comes as Trump insisted Tuesday that Russian interference had no impact on the 2016 election. This is Trump speaking during a news conference with the Swedish prime minister.
Well, the Russians had no impact on our votes whatsoever. But certainly there was meddling, and probably there was meddling from other countries and maybe other individuals. And I think you have to be really watching very closely. You don't want your system of votes to be compromised in any way. And we won't allow that to happen. We're doing a very, very deep study, and we're coming out with some, I think, very strong suggestions on the 18 election. I think we're going to do very well in the 18 election.
The White House has had to correct the record after President Trump apparently confused North Korea and South Korea, mistakenly claiming he had a phone call with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. On Saturday night, Trump said of the conflict with North Korea, quote, it was headed for disaster, and now we're talking. And they, by the way, call up a couple of days ago and said, we would like to talk, unquote. He said this at the gridiron dinner. But Trump has never spoken directly to the North Korean leader. Instead, the White House said Monday, he was referring to a phone call with South Korea's President Moon Jae-in. The Pentagon has concluded its investigation into the October 4th attack in Niger that killed 4 U.S. Special Forces, concluding the team did not get required approval before launching the risky mission. The report concludes the Army Special Forces team never intended to meet with local Nigerian leaders, as higher command thought. Instead, the report says the team's intent from the beginning was to try to capture an alleged militant. During the mission, the small team was attacked by as many as 100 militants linked to ISIS, leading to the deaths of the 4 U.S. Special Forces soldiers and 5 Nigerian soldiers. The incident provoked increased scrutiny of U.S. military operations in Niger, where at least 800 U.S. troops are currently stationed. United Nations investigators have accused the U.S.-led coalition and Russia of potentially violating international law and committing war crimes in Syria during 2017. The new U.N. report comes as the Syrian government, backed by Russia, continues its offensive against Eastern Ghouta outside the capital, Damascus. Activists say 80 people were killed in eastern Ghouta by airstrikes and shelling on Monday alone. Meanwhile, a Russian cargo plane crashed near a Syrian airbase on Tuesday, killing all 39 Russian servicemen on board. The Russian military says the crash was caused by a technical error and that the plane was not shot down. In Honduras, the police have arrested a high-ranking executive with a hydroelectric dam company in connection with the assassination of international renowned Honduran environmentalist Berta Cáceres just over 2 years ago. At the time of her murder, she was fighting the construction of the dam by the company known as DESA. This is Berta Cáceres' mother, Astra Flora, speaking after the arrest.
Today we're asking that they sentence those that are in prison. I believe there are eight and that they capture the masterminds. And also that, internationally, the government of Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez is not recognized because not only he's an imposter, but he also permits these murders in this country.
Officials from two dozen Latin American and Caribbean countries have now signed on to an environmental rights pact aimed at protecting the lives of land defenders. The pact was signed only days after the two-year anniversary of Berta Cáceres' assassination. Meanwhile, in more news from Honduras, activist Edwin Espinal has launched a hunger strike to protest his ongoing imprisonment after he was arrested for protesting against the re-election of the U.S.-backed right-wing president Juan Orlando Hernandez. The Organization of American States says the November election was marred by widespread election fraud. Espinal has been jailed for nearly 2 months. Sri Lanka has declared a state of emergency amidst violence against the Muslim community in Sri Lanka. In recent days, members of the Sri Lanka's Buddhist majority have torched mosques, homes and businesses owned by Muslims. The state of emergency is the first to be declared since Sri Lanka's civil war ended in 2009. This is Sri Lanka's president.
I condemn all the violent incidents that have taken place. Not only do I condemn the violence, I have also instructed the police to take maximum action against individuals, organizations, and/or groups involved in those violent acts.
In Britain, a former Russian spy appears to have been poisoned. Sergei Skripal, an ex-Russian military intelligence officer who once spied for Britain, was found unconscious on a bench in Salisbury on Sunday. In 2006, another former Russian spy was poisoned and died in London, causing years of tensions between Britain and Russia. And women across the world are mobilizing to take to the streets on March 8th, International Women's Day. In Spain, women are poised to stage their first 24-hour nationwide strike. Their motto, if we stop, the world stops. Other protest actions are planned in cities around the world, including here in New York City, where activists are calling for women to launch a one-hour work stoppage from 4 to 5 p.m. and then gather for a rally at Washington Square Park. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in West Virginia. The sound of striking teachers in West Virginia celebrating on Wednesday after winning a 5% raise for all workers as they chanted, "Who made history? We made history." The Wildcat strike began on February 22nd and shut down every public school in the state. It was the longest teacher strike in West Virginia history. The governor, Jim Justice, signed the bill to raise salaries during a news conference Tuesday.
Today is a new day for education in West Virginia. We will move forward. No more looking back. West Virginia renews its investment in education and our precious children today.
Teachers cheered and sang in the halls of the state capitol in Charleston after the pay raise was announced. West Virginia ranked 46th among the 50 U.S. states for average teacher pay last year, according to the National Education Association. One teacher explained the motive for the strike.
It's been very hard because, you know, the teachers have been vilified and they want to be in school just as bad as the parents want the kids to be there. But, you know, this has been going on for so many years and people just, the teachers finally said enough's enough.
While the state's Republican-controlled House of Delegates and Senate were able to reconcile differing bills regarding salary increases, lawmakers have not yet answered teachers' demands for a cap on spiraling health care costs. West Virginia Governor Justice signed an executive order appointing a task force to address the issue. The committee will hold its first meeting next week. The strike in West Virginia has also inspired teachers in other states. On Tuesday, the Oklahoma Education Association announced teachers would go on strike April 23rd if the state legislature doesn't approve pay increases and funding for educational needs. They are the worst paid teachers in the country. For more, we're joined by two guests. In Charleston, we go to Katie Endicott, a high school teacher and union activist in Mingo County, West Virginia. And in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Teresa Danks is with us, an elementary school teacher. She made headlines last year when she panhandled on the side of the road to raise money for schools. She's since started a foundation called Begging for Education, dedicated to classroom funding, improving teacher salaries and fiscal responsibility in Oklahoma. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Katie Endicott, let's begin with you. In Charleston, in the Capitol building there, can you explain the victory that you've achieved, what you think you've achieved, and what you feel needs still to be done?
Yesterday was truly one of the greatest days of my life. We were in the Capitol yesterday. I was here with a group of colleagues, and when we walked in, we fully anticipated that this fight was going to continue. We thought that we would leave and we would come back on Wednesday to the Capitol. And when we found out that the fight was over and that we won, tears were just streaming down our faces. We were overwhelmed with emotion because we won. We saw democracy in action. We saw the power of unity. People from all across the state were coming together, unified with one goal, with one mindset. And we achieved it against all odds. There were so many people who said that we would never get what we wanted. There were so many people who said they would laugh us out of the Capitol. They did not laugh us out of the Capitol because we did not leave the Capitol. And so it was an amazing day. It's been an amazing process to witness and to live history. We know that this is not over. We know that this is just one moment in a much larger movement. And so yesterday on the way home, the talk already shifted to what are we doing next? And so we want to be involved. We're going to be volunteering on campaigns. We're going to be going door knocking for candidates that we believe in. And we certainly do not believe that this is over. We believe that we are just starting.
So for people who haven't been following this historic strike, this was the largest wildcat strike in West Virginia history, one of the largest strikes in West Virginia history as well, the long 9 days. Can you explain what a wildcat strike is and how this strike progressed? Because there was a point last week when the governor said, we're giving you the raise, and then you stayed and you pulled back because you said it's not what you had demanded.
Yes. Striking is actually illegal. We were never encouraged to strike. However, our unions were very supportive of us, and they told us up front, you could lose your job, you could lose seniority, here's all of the risks, but if you choose to, then we will stand beside you and we will support you. And we decided almost unanimously in my county that we were going to strike. We actually, prior to February 22nd, there were four counties in West Virginia who decided to conduct a one-day work stoppage on February 2nd. And we believe that that was the spark that sort of set this whole process in motion. And on that day, like I said, there were people that said, they will laugh you out of the Capitol. And we showed up and there were thousands of people here. And from that point on, it continued. We warned, we told them that we were going to strike. We chanted that here on February 2nd. We said, we will strike. And I do not believe that they heeded that they paid attention. And so sure enough, we showed right back up on February 22nd, and we didn't leave until all of our demands were met.
But once you struck, there was an agreement that you struck with the governor. And explain what happened with the legislature.
Yes. So we, our union leaders met with our governor. I was here that night. It was a Tuesday night, I believe. I had been on a local picket line, and then I drove to Charleston and was here for, we were told there was going to be an announcement made. And at the beginning of that announcement, everyone was very positive. We thought we had won at that point. And then when people came out and they started telling us, our union leaders and so forth, when they started coming out and telling us that the governor had agreed to a 5% raise and that PEIA, which is our insurance, it's an acronym for our insurance program, when they told us that that would remain frozen, the crowd immediately started chanting, "See you tomorrow. See you tomorrow." The governor had agreed with union leaders that we would have a cool-off day, and so we were not scheduled to go back to school until Thursday. Our leadership had agreed that we would go back on Thursday in good faith. But the people of West Virginia, they said, no, we are not going to go back in good faith. You have to, this is the line we've been using, you have to sign, seal, and deliver it. And so we were determined that we were not going back. I went through the hallway on Wednesday during the cool-off day, and I was trying to talk to union leaders, and we were all very clear, we are not going back. We had union meetings across the state. Some people met here on the steps of the Capitol with their union members, and we voted instantly, and it was overwhelming. Everyone was coming through the Capitol, and they were saying, what's Mingo County doing? What's Mason County doing? What's Logan County doing? And everybody was saying, we're not going back. We are not going to go back until they fixed this. And so together we stood, and in spite of a tentative agreement, we said, you can say that, you can make us promises, but you have to actually follow through. Promises alone are not enough. We want it in writing.
So yesterday you achieved a part of what you asked for, enough to return. I wanted to go to the news conference of the Republican governor, of West Virginia's governor, James Justice, questioned whether the teacher salary increases would be paid for through cuts to Medicaid.
You tweeted this morning that you found additional budget cuts to pay for the raises, and the Senate Finance Chairman Blair said these would be deep cuts, $20 million in general service programs, as well as Medicaid. So are you saying that this, what you're about to sign, not only does not address the full funding of the PEIA, but it could also be paid for through cuts to low-income and poor children in their Medicaid, children that teachers teach?
There's not a chance on this plan that that's going to be the case. And the reason it's not going to be the case is we have cash-ending balances in Medicaid that will absolutely backstop any cuts whatsoever to Medicaid, and we will not let our people that are on Medicaid suffer in any way.
So that's Governor Justice. Katie Endicott, your response.
Through this process, I've been so empowered and encouraged to see certain ways that the legislative process works. I've also been very discouraged at moments because we have witnessed the ugly side of politics. And I believe that yesterday, and prior to yesterday, we witnessed that. We witnessed this divisive rhetoric that was meant to divide and vilify teachers and to take away from this monumentous victory that we have achieved. We do believe the governor, we believe our union leadership, that there is no way that Medicaid will lack any funding. It will be fully funded. And we trust our Democratic senators that and our Republican allies that have stood with us through this process, that they would not dare take away from the children of our state.
another clip of Governor Justice. A major point of contention in the negotiations, the teachers' demand for relief from the rising cost of health insurance, as you've described, assessed by the West Virginia Public Employees Insurance Agency, or PIA. Governor Justice announced plans to address the issue during his news conference.
You know, we have created the PEIA task force. And you know, I have done my appointments, and we're waiting on some others to get names to us and get it all put together. And it's just like anything else, whether you budget at your house or whatever you do, at times it takes a little longer. And now we're looking at that all the appointments will be in place by Thursday.
So, Katie Endicott, this idea of setting up a commission that will look at health care, how do teachers feel about this?
We're encouraged by the task force. Initially, we were very skeptical, and we were not ready to return to the classroom just on a promise. However, the executive order certainly helped calm and alleviate a lot of our fears. And so we know that he has put it in writing. We know that this is not a short-term fix, and we know that it can't be fixed within a couple of days. So we wanted to know who would be on that task force. We wanted to make sure that we had representation and that there would be people on that task force that would be speaking for us and that would be our champions. And we believe that we've achieved that. And we are encouraged that there's a date set and that this will come to fruition and that there will be changes made. We do have a freeze in place right now. We did not think that the freeze was enough, but the freeze with the task force certainly helps provide hope for us that there will be a long-term fix and a solution to PEIA.
I wanted to bring Teresa Danks into the conversation, third grade teacher from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I mean, the numbers have ranged, Katie, and when it comes to West Virginia, the teachers get somewhere between, you're like the second lowest paid in the country at 48, 46, really low pay. What do teachers start at in West Virginia, Katie?
The average beginning teacher salary is $33,000 a year, and we are 48th in the nation. So this has been a fight, of course, for insurance, but also pay as well.
So, Teresa Danks, you're in Tulsa, Oklahoma. There has been a lot of organizing that's been going on in Oklahoma right now. Your state has the lowest paid teachers in the country. You made headlines when you started panhandling on the side of the road to raise money for schools. What does this West Virginia victory mean for teachers in Oklahoma, for education, for kids in Oklahoma?
Well, we're thrilled for them. We've been watching them closely, and it's been just exciting to see them have the courage to step up. And I think that's kind of what we've been working for here in Oklahoma, is to have teachers make decisions that are not fear-based and have courage to step up and have their voices heard. So, yeah, we've been very encouraged by what they're doing there.
So what are you demanding in Oklahoma right now?
Well, we started a petition, it's Oklahoma Teacher Walkout Last Resort, on Begging for Education, and that's a Facebook page. And it was basically, we're taking signatures from any taxpayers in the state of Oklahoma, and we're around 30,000 signatures right now. We'd like it to be around 50,000 so we could do an open letter to our governor as kind of a last effort to demand that they do right by the educators of Oklahoma and our children that we serve. We have been kind of congregating here in Oklahoma, and teachers have been pulling together, and we were under the impression that we were getting a lot of our support from our districts and our state, and we had the date of April 3rd in place. Last night when OEA announced the 23rd, we had thousands, including myself, of infuriated teachers. So we've had a little bit of a setback there. And so just people, my phone was blowing up. I was up talking to people. Teachers don't want to wait that late because that's literally the end of our school year. That's after spring break, and that puts us at like 4 weeks till summer. And they want to see action sooner. So we're kind of divided again. And so we're doing our best to rally teachers back together. We have teachers that are just, they're giving up. We're very skeptical here right now. We're kind of maybe a few steps behind West Virginia in that we're not 100% sure that we're having our state legislators and our school districts really supporting us 100%. But the teachers, many of them, are ready to walk out with or without their support. Because as you mentioned, we are the lowest paid in the nation. We can't recruit new teachers. We can't retain the teachers that we have. And we have a lot of teachers that are getting close to retiring. And we are looking at our crisis quickly turning into a tragedy.
And the administrators in the schools, are they supporting you, the superintendents across Oklahoma?
Yes, they are, but they're very slow to move. We've had a lot of support, verbal support. Like I said, we had some things come roll out in writing that were indicating that we were going to have a close down on April 3rd. Teachers were feeling the morale was coming back. Teachers were happy about that, feeling like it would make a difference. But then with OEA's announcement last night with the 23rd, that just completely changed things. So right now, we're not sure what's going to happen because they've actually pulled that post about the 23rd and said that they're, talking it over more. They've heard our voices that, thousands of teachers are furious about that date. We're asking for obviously a $10,000 pay raise. You can go to Arkansas and Texas and a brand new teacher starts out at what our 25-30 year veteran teachers are making here in Oklahoma. It's ridiculous. And it's been that way way too long. We had a strike in Oklahoma in 1990 for the same thing, and we were told back then we would never be in the situation that we find ourselves today.
What was the response to your panhandling on the street for education, for the schools, Teresa?
It was fun in a weird way because I was nervous. I went out there really just trying to set the message last July that send a message that this is where we're at. We are begging. We're begging for our voices to be heard. We picket the Capitol all the time. We go unheard. We get empty promises. Nothing has changed. Teachers in Oklahoma haven't seen a pay raise since 2008. That's ridiculous. And they keep coming up with all these excuses and blaming the blame game back and forth, whose fault it is, but there's been absolutely no action. And I think that is why teachers are where they're at today. On top of that, we're losing teachers so fast we can't keep up, and our population is growing. As far as the panhandling goes, I was able to raise $40,000 through the GoFundMe that I set up. That money has been dispersed back out in my classroom and many, many teachers across the state, and that was a wonderful feeling. I'm still in the process of doing fundraising efforts. Bounce U here in Tulsa is working with me to set up a day for kids to go and bounce and jump and raise money for the beginning of next year. And so I'm still looking at other efforts to raise money to help teachers not have to pay out of pocket, because on top of our low salaries, our high insurance, and all the other problems that are happening in the classroom, teachers are paying out of pocket for everything. And we need our classrooms funded properly so that teachers don't have to do that.
Finally, Katie Endicott, what words of wisdom do you have for Teresa Danks, her experience from this one of the longest wildcat strikes in West Virginia history?
Teresa, I can tell you that everything that you are saying, we have been saying the same thing. It feels so familiar to me to hear the situation that you are in Oklahoma. And one of the things that we have made it very clear about here in West Virginia is that, yes, we were striking for us, but we wanted to inspire teachers all across the nation. The last chant that we had, as soon as we found out that we won, was, "We are worthy." And what I would tell Oklahoma teachers and educators is that you are worthy. And you need to, like she was talking about, step out in courage. One of the things that we learned that was so important was that there will always be people that will tell you the risks, but we in West Virginia can tell you the rewards. And if you can stand in unity, and if you can lock arms with your brothers and sisters, and you can take that courageous step out, you will never regret it, because we've been saying that one voice produces an echo, but thousands of voices produces a roar. And so, Oklahoma, we stand with you here in West Virginia in complete solidarity. We will be watching and following. We will be supporting you every step of the way.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate those words. Very encouraging.
And also, Katie, you'd not only won this 5% raise for teachers in West Virginia, but for all state workers?
Yes, yes. And, you know, again, I talked about the ugly side of politics and the divisive rhetoric. And through this process, I believe that people were trying to win the public over. And there were a lot of people that were trying to turn teachers and educators against public employees. But from the beginning, we have been chanting Five for All. And so we know that we believe in the future of West Virginia, and we know that we deserve more than what we're getting. And so we believe that, you know, it's not just teachers, it's this state. This state has to invest into our future, and they do that by investing into us and into our children. And so we've been saying all along, Five for All. And it was beautiful when I left the Capitol yesterday. There were public employees who were stopping on the side of the road, and they were saying, thank you so much. Thank you for fighting for us. We don't believe what's on the news. We know all along you've been fighting for us. And, you know, again, Oklahoma, we're fighting for you. The last chant that we had here was West Virginia first, Oklahoma next. And so we believe that you are next, and we're going to champion your cause.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us from West Virginia and from Oklahoma. Katie Endicott, high school English teacher in Mingo County, West Virginia, speaking to us from the State House in Charleston. And Teresa Danks, a third grade teacher in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We will continue to follow these struggles. Will the teachers of Oklahoma walk out? And we've just covered the successful strike for teachers in West Virginia. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see our discussion with British university lecturers who have gone out on strike with librarians and staff across England. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Teaching my brothers, teaching sisters of their pride. Up in arms, up in arms, up in arms, I say, here comes the baddest man your eyes have ever graced. 200 years ain't but two things have changed. On my head, Bobby Seale and I have made important progress. It's safe to say that my glory has fled. Up in arms, up in arms, up in arms.
Arms by BB Man. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. On Tuesday, 16 Senate Democrats joined with 50 Republicans to advance a bill slated to roll back key financial regulations passed in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. The bill would exempt 25 of the nation's 40 largest banks from being subject to heightened scrutiny by the Federal Reserve. If it passes, it would be the biggest weakening of the Dodd-Frank Act since it was signed into law in 2010. The 67-32 vote in favor of a motion to proceed now sends the bill back to the floor to debate and possible amendments before a final vote in coming days. This is Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts speaking out against the Senate bank bill.
This bill is a punch in the gut to American consumers. If it passes, it will be harder to police banks that sell abusive mortgages, harder to police lenders who discriminate against their customers, and harder to police giant monopolies that build and sell and offer financing to mobile home buyers. Only a bunch of bank lobbyists and their friends in Washington would call this a consumer protection bill.
Well, for more, we're going to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Alexis Goldstein, senior policy analyst at Americans for Financial Reform. After working on Wall Street for 7 years, she became a prominent member of Occupy Wall Street. We're also going to talk about the resignation of Gary Cohen, a national economic advisor for President Trump. But first, let's start with this bank bill. Alexis Goldstein.
Thanks, Amy. It's good to be here.
So talk about how this has rolled forward. And although there is so much enormous partisan bickering in Washington, when it comes to this bank bill, a number of Democrats are joining with the Republicans. Explain what it will do.
So this bill does three big things. One is that it's going to make future bailouts more likely because it rolls back these important safeguards and monitorings that were put in place after the last crisis and was meant to learn from the mistakes of the last crisis. The other thing is it's going to do is it's going to deregulate a lot of really, really large foreign banks like Deutsche Bank that have presences in the U.S., banks that, like Deutsche, gave large amounts of money and loans to folks like Donald Trump. And then perhaps most worryingly, it's going to possibly encourage further discrimination in mortgage lending because it reduces the reporting requirements on basically 85% of banks, reporting requirements that are used to catch racial discrimination in lending when it occurs. Hmm.
I want to turn to Democratic Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, speaking to Bloomberg TV about why he supports the Senate bank bill.
We've been working on this legislation for 4 years, long before this president came into power, because we hear from community banks, credit unions, folks in our local communities, how some of the regulatory overburden for these smaller institutions has cut back on their lending ability. We want to give that relief. Now, I still believe the banks that caused the major challenge, the largest institutions, the so-called SIFI banks, we need to keep very strict standards in place regulating those institutions. This legislation does that. It does give the relief that we've been working on for 4 years.
So that's Democratic Senator Mark Warner. Can you explain, respond to what he's saying?
So one thing that happened yesterday is the Congressional Budget Office put out its analysis of this bill. And one of the things that they said is there's actually a 50% chance that banks like Citibank, which Mark Warner just said are not impacted by this bill, actually will benefit from this bill. The other thing that he's saying and a lot of the sponsors of this bill, which Senator Warner was one of the original sponsors, are saying is this is just about community banks. But what this is about is raising by five times the threshold by which you get that extra monitoring, by which you get that extra scrutiny by the Fed. It used to be $50 billion. They want to raise it five times to $250 billion. So banks of that size were very crucial to the financial crisis. Countrywide was a bank of that size, and they gave out one out of five of every mortgage in the country in the lead up to the crisis. So these are not small players. Deutsche Bank is not a small player. UBS is not a small player. All of those banks would be deregulated by this bill in substantial ways. And let's not forget the history here. The Fed had all of the tools they needed in order to address the last crisis, and they didn't use them. So Congress made a specific choice in Dodd-Frank to say, hey, Fed, any bank above $50 billion, we're going to require that you do all of these specific things, that you make them run stress tests, that you ensure they don't operate on too much debt. And this bill, unfortunately, is significantly weakening all of those very deliberate protections that Congress put in place after the last
crisis. Let's turn to Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, speaking against the bill.
We're not doing infrastructure. We're not dealing with the opioid crisis. We're doing nothing here about guns, but we got time to do a lot for America's largest banks. These are banks whose collapse with this deregulation, these are banks whose collapse could cause ripples across the world. Together.
The country's biggest banks took $239 billion in taxpayer bailouts. So without the rigorous annual stress test that we put in Dodd-Frank a decade ago and we're relaxing now, taxpayers could once again be on the hook if too big to fail banks collapse and we don't have the right tools in place to see it coming. And it opens the door. And this is maybe even more unbelievable than the fact that this body's fallen all over itself to help the biggest banks. This bill also weakens the oversight for foreign mega banks operating in the United States, the same banks that repeatedly violate U.S. laws.
So is this bank bill a done deal, Alexis Goldstein?
It's absolutely not. And a lot of the Democrats who voted yes on the motion to proceed can absolutely change their mind when this hits the Senate floor. The Congressional Budget Office, in my opinion, gave them all the justification they need to change their vote. The CBO said that this does make future bailouts more likely. And again, there is a 50% chance it also helps really large banks like J.P. Morgan and Citigroup. So if folks are fired up about this, you should absolutely call your senators and let them know to vote no on S2155, which is the bill number.
Think Progress reports many of the banks that are getting relief from this bill also finance assault weapons. Can you explain this?
So Think Progress had a great article yesterday listing specifically all of the banks that finance assault weapons manufacturers. And there's at least 12 banks on that list that also benefit from this bill by my count. So these are banks like Citizens and Regions and other banks like that. And so it just strikes me as a very strange time for the Democrats to be teaming up with Republicans to deregulate banks, including banks that are helping fund and finance the companies that are used in these horrible mass murders and shootings and school shootings that we've been seeing. The Democrats have a lot of leverage here. This is not a bill that could pass without 60 votes. They could be using that leverage to demand things. And unfortunately, right now, they're not.
Well, before we go, I wanted to ask you about the resignation of President Trump's top economic adviser, Gary Cohn, who opposed the president's plan to impose tariffs on steel, aluminum. Cohn, the director of National Economic Council, before taking that position, president of Goldman Sachs. Can you talk about the significance of his leaving?
I mean, I just think it's very unfortunate, but not surprising. Perhaps, you know, Gary Cohn did not choose to leave after Charlottesville, although he tried to get some media attention saying that he was thinking about leaving. He did not choose to leave after the Muslim ban. He did not choose to leave after, you know, President Trump ended DACA. He chose to leave after Wall Street's profits were being threatened. And unfortunately, I think that's part and parcel to the culture of Wall Street, which I used to participate in, which is you want PR credit for, you know, trying to say, oh, yes, we support the dreamers. But when the rubber hits the road, Wall Street banks are not lobbying for a Clean Dream Act. They're lobbying for bills like the one we just discussed.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Alexis Goldstein, for joining us, senior policy analyst at Americans for Financial Reform, nonpartisan coalition of over 200 groups working for a safe and ethical financial system, former Occupy Wall Street activist who was before that a Wall Street banker. And this update on our previous segment, as we talked about the teacher strike in West Virginia that's just ended and what's happening with Oklahoma teachers, we just got word that University of Illinois graduate students who are on strike now are occupying the president's office. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Texas, where the first midterm primaries took place yesterday. Are we going to see the year of the woman? Stay with us. and by the Texas fan Krongbin. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. This year's midterm elections officially began Tuesday as Democratic and Republican primaries were held throughout Texas. Democrats are hoping Texas could become a key state in the party's effort to retake control of the Senate and House. A record 50 women were on the ballot in what many are calling the year of the woman. On Tuesday, Congressman Beto O'Rourke won the Democratic Party, the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. He'll take on incumbent Ted Cruz, who easily won the Republican primary, though the El Paso congressman, O'Rourke, outraised Cruz in the last months. On the House side, Democrats are putting up candidates in every Texas district for the first time in over a quarter of a century. In one of the most watched Democratic races, progressive Democrat Laura Moser placed second, forcing a runoff against Lizzie Pinnell Fletcher, an attorney who's been criticized for working at a law firm that's targeted unions in Texas. The race is seen as a war within the Democratic Party. Moser was endorsed by Our Revolution, the political organization that grew out of Bernie Sanders' run for the White House. Fletcher was backed by the Democratic Party. In February, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee took the unusual step of directly attacking Moser, even though she's a Democrat. Moser and Fletcher will now face off in a runoff to decide who will face Republican Congressman John Culberson in November. In other primary news, Texas appears poised to send its first Latina women to Congress this year. Next year, the election would be later this year. Former El Paso County Judge Veronica Escobar and State Senator Sylvia Garcia won their respective Democrat primaries in heavily Democratic districts. To talk more about the results in Texas, we go to Austin, where we're joined by Mike Barajas, a staff writer for the Texas Observer. Mike, you've been following this all very closely. Give us the highlights.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Democrats do have reason to be enthusiastic after after yesterday's primary. Early vote totals showed a pretty big surge in Democrats that were coming out to vote in that party's primary.
Something like a million Democrats and 1.5 million Republicans?
Right, yeah. So Election Day totals were a little bit below what I think Democrats had ultimately hoped for. But still, we're seeing record turnout over 2014 in particular. I think it's something like double, at least, the amount of primary voters in the Democratic Party that we're seeing. So naturally, this is still a red state. This is still Texas, after all. So we're seeing that growth by a pure numbers standpoint. You know, there wasn't as much growth on the Republican side, but there are still something like 1.5 million Republican primary voters in Texas. So that tells you what Democrats might need to overcome in the general, but that also sort of is kind of an indicator of, you know, how much enthusiasm Democrats have going into the general election. Now, that could be for a number of different reasons. That could be because, you know, Texas is changing. Texas in the last presidential race, you know, it went, I think, 9 points to Trump. But that's a smaller margin, I think, than I think they said that's the smallest margin of any Republican presidential candidate in Texas in something like 20 years. So you mentioned the congressional seats. You know, there are a handful here in Texas that were seen as not that long ago, deeply entrenched, you know, Republican seats until, you know, last presidential election, they voted, you know, some in a small margin, but for Hillary. So that includes the seat out in Houston that Moser's running in now in the runoff. That we clearly know what the DCCC thinks about that race.
Let's talk about that. The progressive group Our Revolution endorsing the Democratic congressional hopeful Laura Moser a week after her own party, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, released an opposition memo on her. I want to turn to a part of one of Moser's campaign ads.
Most of us would prefer not to spend the most money for the least efficient healthcare system in the world. Most of us don't think that women should go back to work within 14 days of giving birth. Most of us don't want our kids drinking from lead pipes or having preventable asthma attacks. Most of us also aren't that into raiding people's homes and separating mothers from their children and arresting refugees who've risked their lives multiple times to escape their war-torn homelands. My grandfather came here in 1942 as a refugee from Nazi Germany. Houston welcomed him, as Houston has welcomed hundreds of thousands of people like him over the decades.
So So that's Laura Moser's ad. This is very unusual, Mike, that the Democratic Party took a position in the Democratic primary attacking her.
Yeah, and it tells you who they think. It tells you how they think this district's going to vote at the very least. I can't remember if they outright said this, but this is an indication that they don't think that kind of progressive candidate or that kind of candidate with an outright progressive message is going to be competitive against a Republican incumbent in that district. Who knows? Texas, like I said, has been changing in recent years. You know, there are a lot of factors at play. The anti-Trump sentiment that seems to be sweeping not just the country, but also parts of this state, particularly metro and suburban parts of this state. Clearly voters thought she belonged in at least that runoff for the primary.
That runoff will take place on May 22nd. Now, what about Beto O'Rourke, right, the El Paso congressman? We spoke to him when we were doing a piece on a Mexican journalist who has been jailed for months. And he had visited him and was calling for his release. This El Paso congressman, Beto O'Rourke, has now gone, throughout the state in a very unusual primary campaign and outraised Ted Cruz in the last month. So, of course, ultimately, Ted Cruz has much more money.
Yeah, I think the last figures that I saw were something like, 6 to 5 million between the two campaigns. Beto O'Rourke has clearly, launched what's looking like a pretty credible campaign for Senate. The Democratic Party here is looking at him as sort of he's the marquee race. They didn't field a lot of big name candidates for governor, even though some folks had been looking at a rising star like one of the Castro twins from San Antonio. Nobody was willing to jump into that race, in part because Texas maybe is seen as still too red to elect a statewide candidate like that for governor. But there's at least one statewide race where Democrats are really putting a lot of their hopes, and that's Beto O'Rourke. And like you said, he's crossed the state. He came out of the primary, with a clear victory. He's not going to go to a runoff, so there's no sort of awkward split there. And he's going up against, in the general, who is widely seen as a pretty unpopular incumbent. Ted Cruz certainly seems to be taking him seriously. I just saw him on MSNBC talking about gun control and really trying to define this race as, the liberal congressman from El Paso coming to take your guns, Texas. So I think it's still safe to call that a long shot. But, Texas looks different now than it did in 2014.
It's one of four minority majority states, and very significant for that. Can you talk about the two Latina women who are poised to become the first two Latina Congress members from Texas?
Yeah. So, Texas is going to get a couple firsts. Just from the primary results last night, one of the presumptive members of Congress that you're talking about is out of Houston, Sylvia Garcia, who was a state senator. She's going to take over a congressional seat that was created as a minority opportunity district back in the 90s in Houston, and that went to a white Democrat. And for two decades, Houston hasn't had a member of Congress who's a Hispanic. Not only are they going to get that this time around, but she's going to be one of the first Latina congressmen or Congress members in the state. That same goes for Escobar out of El Paso. She won that race in a crowded field. I think it was seven candidates, and she pulled away with something like 60% of the vote. A pretty strong showing, and she, will again be one of the history makers, one of Texas's first Latina members of Congress.
And you may have one first openly lesbian member of Congress.
Right. That's another one of those races that that Democrats have targeted this this particular election. That's Will Hurd currently holds the seat down in South Texas. It's this sprawling district that goes from San Antonio all the way out into West Texas. Because of how heavily gerrymandered it is, a lot of people see it as a toss-up now. Gina Jones-Ortiz is the candidate that you're talking about. She came away with a pretty clear lead in a crowded field for that primary, something like 40%. So she's looking pretty good going into the runoff there. And you're right, if she goes up against Will Hurd and ultimately wins that race, she would be Texas's first openly gay member of Congress.
Mike Barajas, thanks so much for being with us. That does it for our show. Staff writer for the Texas Observer. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now. Thanks for joining us.